Listening to a heartbeat, swimming in its rhythm, is an experience first shared by every person on Earth. We Are Movement's current project is Public Radio, Public Space. A heartbeat soundscape. Resting heartbeat varies its rhythm. This physiological phenomenon of this variation in the time between beats is called heart rate variability. The time between beats can range from less than 0.5 seconds to more than 2 seconds. The potential sequence of each of our heartbeats is thus infinite. The fabric of the potential sequences of all our heartbeats is mind-boggling. Yet, our heartbeats sync when we speak, sing, dance, and move together. This embodied public space was brought to you by Women's Magazine, Mutiny Radio, and We Are Movement. To find out more, visit wearemovement.org. Hello and welcome to Women's Magazine. This is Global Val here at MutinyRadio.fm in San Francisco. Thank you for listening. Happy Friday. It's a beautiful, beautiful day here in the city. It's April 3rd. And springtime. Oh, springtime. Such a potent season. And I think for women, it might be especially potent. So I want to read a poem from Diane de Prima, who of course was came about here in the Beat generation, and then was at in the early 2000s was named the Poet Laureate of San Francisco. And it is April, so that means it is National Poetry Month. And at the end of April, April 29th, at San Francisco City Hall, we'll be hosting the 10th annual Poems Under the Dome. It's the mother of all open mics. You are welcome to come down to City Hall, inside City Hall. This is not some sort of protest on the steps. We will be inside. We'll be in the North Light Court, which is one of the large ballrooms off of the center rotunda on the first floor of City Hall. It is a free all ages event, and we encourage you to come, bring your friends and family, come and enjoy the poetry. Or if you are a poet, or if you have a poem that you like, something that touches you, tickles to you, is true to your heart, you can come and put your name in the hat that evening. And if we pull your name, you may get up there and read that poem. We do ask that you just read one poem and limit yourself to 3 minutes or less. So poemdome.net. We'll have more information about that. This is all volunteer organization here, Poems Under the Dome. But some volunteers will be going around to the local poetry open mics around San Francisco in the month of April to start drawing names early. So if you frequent one of those open mics, you may just see one of our friends wandering in to announce that they're doing a drawing. And so if you put your name in and your name gets pulled at that poetry open mic event, that means you are guaranteed a space to read at San Francisco City Hall. That's Wednesday, April 29th from 5:30 to 8 p.m. sharp. And we hope to see you all there. Happy Poetry Month, everybody. Here's a poem from Diane de Prima, Revolutionary Letter Number 4. Left to themselves, people grow their hair. Left to themselves, they take off their shoes. Left to themselves, they make love, sleep easily, share blankets, dope, and children. They're not lazy or afraid. They plant seeds. They smile. They speak to one another. The word coming into its own. Touch of love on the brain, the ear. We return to the sea, the tides. We return as often as leaves, as numerous as grass, gentle, insistent. We remember the way. Our babes toddle barefoot through the cities of the universe. And now, some Joni Mitchell. Joni Mitchell fell ill earlier this week. And so she, of course, has added to our landscape of music and culture and transcendent messages. So let's go to Joni Mitchell. You're listening to Women's Magazine.
This next song that I'm going to play is about one of these pop festivals that they've been having around the world lately. It's one that I didn't really get to go to. I'd been playing the night before in Chicago with a band, friends of mine, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, etc., etc. And it was their first professional appearance, and we were all kind of excited about it. And the next night, we were supposed to all play in Woodstock, and I had to do a TV show the next day, so I kind of got left behind because they were having problems getting people in and getting them back out again and everything. So I stayed home in New York, and I watched it on television all day and saw everybody there playing and singing, and it was really a nice festival, I guess, and from the looks of everything. And well, I wrote a little song for my friends to sing, and for myself to sing as well. And it's called Woodstock. It goes like this.
Man, I don't know who I am, but you know, like
by the time we got to Woodstock, we were half a million strong, and everywhere there was song in a celebration. And I dreamed I saw the bombers riding shotgun in the sky.
Joni Mitchell, live in concert, 1970, singing Woodstock. She didn't even make it. What a doll she is. So we send her the best and wish her a speedy recovery. And I want to continue. You're listening to Women's Magazine on MutinyRadio.fm. This is Global Val. Thanks for joining me. And several weeks back, kind of towards the end of 2014, early and in January, February, I was reading a little bit from a book called When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone. And it's the story of the most ancient of religions, the religion of the goddess, and the role this ancient worship played in Judeo-Christian attitudes towards women. This is chapter 2, and it's called Who Was She? It was not long before the various pieces of evidence fell into place and the connections began to take form. And then I understood. Ashtoreth, the despised, quote, pagan deity of the Old Testament, was, despite the efforts of biblical scribes to disguise her identity by repeatedly using the masculine gender, was actually Astarte, the great goddess. And she was known in Canaan, the Near Eastern queen of heaven. Those heathen idol worshippers of the Bible had been praying to a woman god, elsewhere known as Inin, Inanna, Nana, Nut, Anat, Anahita, Ishtar, Isis, Oset, Ishara, Asherah, Ashtart, Atoret, Ator, and Hathor, the many-named divine ancestress. Yet each name denoted, in the various languages and dialects of those who revered her, the great goddess. Was it merely coincidence that during all those years of Sunday school, I never learned that Ashtoreth was female? Even more astonishing was the archaeological evidence, which proved that her religion had existed and flourished in the Near and Middle East for thousands of years before the arrival of the patriarchal Abraham, first prophet of the male deity Yahweh. Archaeologists had traced the worship of the goddess back to the Neolithic communities of about 7,000 BC, some to the upper Paleolithic cultures of about 20,000 BC. From the time of its Neolithic origins, its existence was repeatedly attested to until well into the Roman times. Yet, Bible scholars agreed that it was It was as late as somewhere between 1800 and 1500 BC that Abraham had lived in Canaan, currently Palestine. Who was this goddess? Why had a female, rather than a male, been designated as a supreme deity? How influential and significant was her worship? And when had it actually begun? As I asked myself these questions, I began to probe even deeper into the Neolithic and Paleolithic times. Though goddesses have been worshipped in all areas of the world, I focused on the religion as it evolved in the Near and Middle East, since these were the lands where both Judaism, Christianity, and Islam were born. I found that the development of the religion of the female deity in this area was intertwined with the earliest beginnings of religion so far discovered anywhere on Earth. Again, reading from When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone. I'll read this next little part, and then I want to read you a poem. And then at 3 o'clock, we'll have the Common Thread Collective. Dawn in the Gravesian Garden of Eden. The Upper Paleolithic period, though most of its sites have been found in Europe, is the conjectural foundation of the religion of the goddess as it emerged in the later Neolithic age in the Near East. Since it precedes the time of written records and does not directly lead into an historical period that might have helped explain it, the information on the Paleolithic existence of goddess worship must, at this time, remain speculative. Theories on the origin of the goddess in this period are founded on the juxtaposition of the mother kinship customs to ancient ancestor worship. They are based upon three separate lines of evidence. The first relies on an anthropological analogy to explain the initial development of matrilineal or mother kinship societies. Studies of, quote, primitive tribes over the last few centuries have led to the realization that some isolated, quote, primitive peoples, even in our own century, did not possess the conscious understanding of the relationship of sex to conception. The analogy is then drawn that Paleolithic people may have been at a similar level of biological awareness. Chiquetta Hawks wrote in 1963 that, quote, Australian and a few other primitive peoples did not understand biological paternity or accept a necessary connection between sexual intercourse and conception, end quote. In that same year, S.G.F. Brandon, professor of comparative religion at the University of Manchester in England, observed, quote, how the infant came to be in the womb was undoubtedly a mystery to primitive man. In view of the period that separates impregnation from birth, it seems improbable that the significance of gestation and birth was appreciated long before it was realized that these phenomena were the result of conception following coition. End quote. But it goes on. James Frazer, Margaret Mead, and other anthropologists, writes Leonard Cottrell, have established that in the very early stages of man's development, before the secret of human fecundity was understood, before coitus was associated with childbirth, the female was revered as the giver of life. Only women could produce their own kind, and man's part in this process was not as yet recognized. End quote. According to these authors, as well as many authorities who have written on this subject, in the most ancient human societies, people probably did not yet possess the conscious understanding of the relationship of sex to reproduction. Thus, the concepts of paternity and fatherhood would not yet have been understood. Though probably accompanied by various mythical explanations, babies were simply born from women. If this was the case, then the mother would have been seen as the singular parent of her family, the lone producer of the next generation. For this reason, it would be natural for children to take the name of their mother's tribe or clan. Accounts of descent in the family would be kept through the female line, going from mother to daughter, rather than from father to son, as is the custom in practice Western societies today. Such a social structure is generally referred to as matrilineal, that is, based upon mother kinship. In such cultures, known among many primitive peoples even today, as well as in historically attested societies at the time of classical Greece, not only the names, but titles, possessions, and territorial rights are passed along through the female line so that they may be retained within the family clan. Hawks points out that in Australia, in areas where the concept of paternity had not yet been understood, Quote, there is much to show that matrilineal descent and matrilocal marriage, where the husband moving into the wife's family home or village, were general, and the status of women much higher, end quote. She writes that these customs still prevail in parts of Africa and among the Dravidians of India, and the relics of them in Melanesia, Micronesia, and Indonesia. The second line of evidence concerns the beginnings of religious beliefs and rituals and their connection with matrilineal descent. There have been numerous studies of Paleolithic cultures, explorations of sites occupied by these people, and the apparent rites connected, R-I-T-E-S, rites connected with the disposal of their dead. These suggest that, as the earliest concepts of religion developed, they probably took the form of ancestor worship. Again, an analogy is drawn between the Paleolithic people and the religious concepts and rituals observed among many, quote, primitive tribes studied by anthropologists over the last two centuries. Ancestor worship occurs among tribal people the world over. Meringer states that even at the time of his writing in 1956, certain tribes in Asia were still making small statues known as Zuli, explaining, he says, quote, these idols are female and represent the human origins of the whole tribe. Thus, as the religious concepts of the earliest Homo sapiens were developing, and note, the term Homo sapien literally means knowing or knowledgeable man, thus the religious concepts of the earliest Homo sapiens were developing, the quest for the ultimate source of life, perhaps the core of all theological thought, may have begun. In these upper Paleolithic societies in which the mother may have been regarded as the sole parent of the family, ancestor worship was apparently the basis of sacred ritual, and accounts of ancestry were probably reckoned only through the matriline. The concept of the creator of all human life may have been formulated by the clan's image of the woman who had been their most ancient, their primal ancestor, and that image thereby deified and revered as divine ancestress. The third line of evidence, and the most tangible, derives from the numerous sculptures of women found in the Gravesian or Aurignacian cultures of the upper Paleolithic Age. Some of these date as far back as 25,000 BC. These small female figurines made of stone and bone and clay, and often referred to as Venus figures, have been found in areas where small settled communities once lived. They were often discovered lying close to the remains of sunken walls of what were probably the earliest human-made dwellings on Earth. Meringer claims that the niches or depressions had been made in the walls to hold the figures. These statues of women, some seemingly pregnant, have been found throughout the widespread Gravesian or Ignatian sites in the areas as far apart as Spain, France, Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Russia. These sites and figures appear to span a period of at least 10,000 years. It appears highly probable then, says Meringer, that the female figures were idols of a great mother cult, practiced by the non-nomadic Aurignacian mammoth hunters who inhabited the immense Eurasian territories that extended from southern France to Lake Baikal in Siberia. End quote. Incidentally, it is from this Lake Baikal area in Siberia that the tribes which migrated to North America, supposedly about the same period they're developing into the American Indians, are believed to have originated. Lake Baikal, Siberia. Russian paleontologist Z.A. Abramova, quoted in Alexander Marshak's recent book, Roots of Civilization, offers a slightly different interpretation, writing that in the Paleolithic religion, quote, the image of the woman mother was a complex one, and it included diverse ideas related to the special significance of the women in early clan society. She was neither a god, an idol, nor the mother of a god. She was the clan mother. The ideology of the hunting tribes in this period of the matriarchal clan was reflected in the female figurines. And that was chapter 2 from When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone. And I look forward to sharing future chapters with you as we delve into the archaeology, the herstory beyond the history, to see the ancient goddess religion and the worship of the woman. And it is springtime, so it is a potent season, as I mentioned earlier. And I see people are setting up for the next show while I finish up this one.
I go in and out.
Thanks, guys. It was a live radio station here, and I appreciate everybody for helping set up for the Common Thread Collector, which is coming up in just a few moments. Thank you all for listening. And so, yes, Merlin Stone, When God Was a Woman. Just think about it, you know. Where are we going with this concept of worshiping a man in the sky? Really? Really? You know, benevolent, but scary, you know, forgiving, but, you know, punitive. It's kind of a schizophrenic notion, religion. But delving into the ancient goddess religion based on very primitive understandings of life and the source of life. And so I'd like to leave you with a poem, and then I will leave you with a Joni Mitchell song. And when I come back, it will be the Common Thread Collective. This poem is called Skipping March. There hasn't been a drop in March all these past 3 years. Even when I got it back, February and April proved the ears to this empty-headed month, guilelessly skipping the third moon. As I writhe in some springtime schizophrenia, body invading mind, head occupied with body, neither one listening to reason, just the wash of a flooded season, both secretly serenading me, but off tune. And so I skip a beat in my rhythm, feeling the heat of another season, friends juicing up like melons, growing overnight gardens, lush and aflush with the momentum of motherhood, harps being strummed by seraphim and cherubim, wide eyes immodest come flying in my door, and I still turn away to ignore. The reins are on, and I'm stopping this wagon with my heels, lines in the dust and etched are there to cross, and the soft smell of dirt satisfies my senses in a whiff before it gets whisked away. I'm Global Val, Valerie Ibera, and it's nice to be here at Mutiny Radio every Friday from 2 to 3 for Women's Magazine and from 3 to 6 for the Common Thread Collective. You are welcome to come down and join us for the Common Thread Collective. The door is open. We have microphones set up. You can play your music, read your poetry, tell us what's going on in your community, which is our community too. We're spreading the word and spreading the love into the 21st century around the world. That's what I'm doing. Yeah, you can check out my blog, globalval.blogspot.com. And we are here in San Francisco, so let's play a home tune and send some more love out to our sister, Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening. Peace. And remember, just when your aspirations seemed outrageous, that inspiration is contagious. Peace and thank you.
Reading the news and it sure looks bad. They won't give peace a chance. That was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. All the California, California, coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset peak. California, I'm coming home. I met a redneck on a Grecian Isle who did the goat dance very well. He gave me back my smile, but he kept my camera in a cell. Oh, the rogue, the red, red rogue. He cooked good omelets and stews, and I might have stayed on with him there, but my heart cried out for you. California, oh, California, coming home. Oh, make me feel good, rock and roll band, I'm your biggest fan. California, I'm coming home. Oh, the streets are full of strangers. All the news on your ear just give you the blues. Just give you the blues. So I bought me a ticket, I caught a plane to Spain. Went to a party down a red dirt road. There were lots of pretty people there, reading Rolling Stone, reading Vogue. I said, how long can you hang around? I said, a week, maybe two, just until my skin turns brown. And I'm going home to California. California, I'm coming home. Oh, will you take me as I am? Strung out on another man. California, I'm coming home. Streets are full of strangers.